The Syrian civil war continues to escalate.
Syrian rebels say they are now fighting in the countryside of Hama after taking villages, towns, and much of Syria's second city, Aleppo.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz visits Kyiv.
Scholz said German support for Ukraine will remain strong. He emphasized that Ukraine can rely on Germany and that Germany will continue to fulfill all promises and agreements reached with Ukraine.
And an iconic landmark in Paris prepares for reopening.
It's taken 5 years, 2,000 artisans and workers, and more than $700 million to restore the medieval Gothic masterpiece.
Today is Tuesday, December 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Beginning the show today in Syria, it's the largest escalation of the civil war in years. Syrian rebels have taken considerable ground, including most of Syria's second city, Aleppo, and they continue to fight toward the city of Hama. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul with help from Mawaya Atrash and Ahmad Falah in Idlib and Aleppo.
Syrian rebels say they are now fighting in the countryside of Hama after taking villages, towns, and much of Syria's second city, Aleppo, in the largest escalation of the Syrian civil war in several years. Meanwhile, Syrian and Russian airstrikes continue to hit rebel-held territories as Syrian President Bashar al-Assad fortifies the front lines with heavy weaponry and soldiers against forces they call terrorists, according to Syrian state media. For some families, renewed fighting means returning to homes they long ago fled. This is Hannah Bereket, returning home after being displaced for 5 years.
Our house is burnt. There is nothing left but walls and ceiling. But we are happy to be here. I am with my husband and children, and we are happy. Thank God.
The United Nations says the violence has forced thousands of others to flee their homes and disrupted humanitarian assistance in the region. Hundreds of people have been killed, including dozens of civilians. Rebel soldiers launched the offensive last week as key Syrian government allies, Hezbollah and Russia, had become increasingly embroiled in wars with Israel and Ukraine. Rebel fighters say they have been waiting for years to take lands from the government's control. Shamil al-Hamzi is a soldier with the rebel forces.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala fatah alayna khilal yawmin aw thalath ayyam.
God the Almighty allowed us to take this area in a couple of days. This area that has been controlled by the government for many years. But God the Almighty has now replaced it with us in only a few days.
Inside the city of Aleppo, locals say they hope whoever is in charge next will improve basic living conditions. This woman is a resident of Aleppo. She doesn't want to give her name for fear that government forces will retake the city.
We are oppressed and deprived. If someone wants to travel, the government stops us. It's a very difficult situation. The living conditions are depressing. We don't know where to go. Even the rents are too expensive.
The latest flare-up in this 13-year conflict is further complicating matters in the region and raising the potential for a larger confrontation. Iran has reaffirmed its staunch support for the Assad government, while the United States, in the midst of a transfer of power, is calling for all sides to protect civilian lives and infrastructure in Aleppo and elsewhere. Heather Murdoch in Istanbul with Muawiyah Atrash in Aleppo and Idlib, Syria. VOA News.
Turning now to Europe, the exiled Russian opposition is looking to organize a new strategy while waiting for U.S. President-elect Donald Trump to fulfill his campaign promise to end Russian President Vladimir Putin's war with Ukraine. It's something the opposition leaders fear could mean a loss of U.S. support. Elizabeth Chernev narrates this report by Ricardo Marquina.
After nearly 3 years of full-scale war in Ukraine, the Russian opposition to President Vladimir Putin is at a difficult crossroads, with the movement's prominent figures in exile and those left behind forced to remain silent or face imprisonment. The opposition finds itself with no clear leadership. One of Putin's main opponents, Ilya Yashin, welcomes us in Berlin, where he resides after being released from a Russian prison as part of a historic swap in August.
The Russian opposition had a leader, Boris Nemtsov. He was killed. The Russian opposition had another leader, Alexei Navalny. He was arrested and poisoned in prison. Today, there is no current task to join around one person. It seems to me that it is much more important to consolidate around common values.
The values of freedom and justice underpin the opposition's demands at a big November demonstration in Berlin, namely the withdrawal of Russian troops from Ukrainian soil, freedom for political prisoners in Russia, and bringing Putin to justice. The transfer of power in Washington next month is cause for concern among Russia's opposition in exile, which is waiting to see whether Donald Trump's pledge to quickly achieve peace in Ukraine will represent a radical change in military and political support for Kyiv. Trump has pledged to end the war before he takes office, but not said how. During a campaign debate in September, he refused to say that he wants Ukraine to win.
Until now, in the U.S. Congress, both Democrats and Republicans agree that Ukraine must be supported and that Putin is an aggressor. Now, another president will come, but we think the Congress continues to allocate money and will continue to allocate money to Ukraine.
But focusing solely on the actions or desires of the new administration is misguided, say some observers who consider it naive to think Putin wants peace.
From Putin's point of view, the Russian army is advancing. The economy continues to hold. Now, for the Kremlin, there is no need to compromise. So I would say that Trump will really try, but sooner or later, most likely, the United States will return to help Ukraine. The war will continue.
The war in Ukraine has been escalating ahead of the coming changes in Washington. Trump takes office January 20th. Meanwhile, exiled members of Russia's anti-war movement are trying to find a way to address a new reality. For Ricardo Marquina in Berlin, Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News.
In a related story, the United States will provide Ukraine with a $725 million weapons package, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Monday, as President Joe Biden's outgoing administration seeks to bolster the government in Kyiv before leaving office in January. Similarly, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz visited the Ukrainian capital on Monday and said German support for Ukraine will remain strong. Our correspondent Anna Chernikova has more from Kyiv.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz arrived in Kyiv on Monday on an unannounced visit. Scholz said German support for Ukraine will remain strong. He emphasized that Ukraine can rely on Germany and that Germany will continue to fulfill all promises and agreements reached with Ukraine. Scholz met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Together, they honored the memory of the Ukrainian soldiers lost in the war, and they visited wounded Ukrainian soldiers undergoing treatment and rehabilitation in Kyiv. They also inspected the latest developments of automatic target detection and engagement systems, in particular UAVs, FPV drones, and complex robotics, and drone control systems, which were created in Ukraine in cooperation with German companies. During a joint press conference, Zelensky thanked Germany for all the support provided and emphasized that Germany is a leader in Europe in providing aid to Ukraine. Zelensky said Ukraine is especially grateful for the air defense systems provided by Germany. In turn, Scholz announced a new package of military assistance to Ukraine worth $680 million and said that Ukraine would receive the six Iris-T air defense system, Patriot launchers and Gepard anti-aircraft systems from Germany in December. Scholz also confirmed that Germany would continue supplying weapons in 2025, including air defense, drones, and helicopters. This is the first bilateral visit of the German Chancellor to Ukraine in more than 2 years, and Monday's visit is happening amid uncertainty inside Germany regarding the budget for the next year and the upcoming election. European analysts say the opposition to supporting Ukraine in Germany is increasing, which creates additional pressure on Scholz. On the other hand, the German opposition is blaming Scholz for lack of action, as he continues to oppose the idea of providing long-range missiles to Ukraine to hit military targets inside Russia. Meanwhile, Russian forces continue constant attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure and residential areas. Sunday night, one of the drones hit a residential building in the western city of Ternopil, killing a man and heavily injuring his wife, who was protecting the family's youngest daughter with her body. The mother is currently in the hospital with serious burnings. Two daughters are safe. It was the first deadly attack in the city of Ternopil. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. The Israeli military said on Monday it struck dozens of targets throughout Lebanon, shortly after Hezbollah accused Israel of violating a ceasefire agreement and fired missiles on an Israeli military position in the disputed Sheba Farms area. Residents in Beirut told Reuters they heard drones flying overhead late in the evening, as Lebanon's official news agency reported that Israel had renewed strikes in southern Lebanon. Earlier, Hezbollah launched what it called a defensive warning strike. Officials and witnesses say chaos erupted at a soccer game in Guinea after fans protested a referee's call and thousands of panicked spectators tried to flee the stadium, leaving at least 56 people dead. Local media reported that security forces used tear gas. A journalist covering the game for a local sports website said many of the dead were crushed as they tried to escape through the stadium gates. The U.S. State Department has approved the potential sale of equipment and follow-on support for MH-60R Seahawk helicopters to India for an estimated cost of $1.17 billion, the Pentagon said on Monday. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Turning our attention to American politics now, electric vehicles have become a political lightning rod recently. Many Democrats and environmentalists believe they're one of many necessary steps to mitigate climate change, and they support government subsidies to make them more affordable. On the other hand, many conservatives, who are less inclined to think climate change is a real problem, think they are too expensive and not developed enough to replace traditional gasoline-powered cars. Not surprisingly, electric vehicle manufacturers are hoping for continued growth under President-elect Donald Trump, especially as Tesla CEO Elon Musk now appears to be one of his top advisors. Genia DeLute has our story from the Los Angeles Auto Show.
Earlier in his presidential campaign, Donald Trump bashed Joe Biden for backing electric vehicles.
Think of this. He wants electric vehicle mandates that will spell the death of the U.S. auto industry.
In his campaign's closing month, Trump got a big boost from electric vehicle CEO Elon Musk.
He created the first major American car company in generations and his rocket company. Is the only reason we can now send American astronauts into space. Take over, Elon, yes, take over.
Since Trump's win, Musk has agreed to join his new government to help improve efficiency. Musk has also seen share prices for his electrical vehicle firm Tesla jump more than 25% since Election Day, topping $1 trillion in market value for the first time in 2 years. So what are electric vehicle manufacturers expecting from a Trump team that includes the Tesla chief? At the LA Auto Show, Shiv Sikand is showing off the quad motor, all-electric Draker supercar.
It's super exciting to think that, you know, Elon is there and, you know, the president is, you know, taking it very seriously, and I think will be very powerful for American industry, not just electric cars, you know, right across the spectrum. Our goal is to be more competitive, particularly, you know, in the threat of foreign competition.
With Trump promising import tariffs, electric vehicles built in the United States may be more competitive. South Korean automaker Hyundai will build its IONIQ 9 electric truck in the U.S. state of Georgia, says company spokesman Miles Johnson.
An IONIQ 9 will be built there. There are two battery joint venture plants going into Georgia as well. So the batteries will be sourced in the U.S. market, and the vehicles will be produced in the U.S. market. So we're committed to the U.S. market.
Electric vehicle manufacturers are also mindful that Trump may end the $7,500 federal tax credit for EV buyers. John Thomas of Ampere Charging Systems says it is part of the market's evolution.
Hopefully you're not incentivizing something forever, right, at the end of the day. Hopefully the incentive is what kicks off an industry, and then you slowly pull that back. And I think that's been things we've seen in Europe.
The vehicle guide Kelly Blue Book says a record 1.2 million electric vehicles were sold in the United States last year, accounting for more than 7% of the total U.S. vehicle market. Jenny Adulo, VOA News, Los Angeles.
After promising to visit Africa 2 years ago at the U.S.-Africa summit in Washington, President Joe Biden makes his first presidential trip to the continent, where he's visiting Angola, along with making a quick stop in Cabo Verde. Analysts in Africa say the trip should have come sooner, and some are asking why Angola is the primary destination, given its troubling human rights record. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Miriam Diallo has our story.
White House officials say President Joe Biden is looking forward to visiting the continent after a promise he made in 2022. But some analysts tell VOA that Biden's trip, which comes weeks before he steps down, would have had more weight if he had done it earlier. Lo Nell, senior political analyst for Oxford Economics Africa, spoke to VOA from South Africa.
I think his trip is less significant than it would have been otherwise, just because of the fact that he obviously withdrew as the presidential candidate, and then, of course, is now not returning for a second term. So it very much feels like an afterthought to his presidency.
After a short stop in the island nation of Cabo Verde off Africa's northwest coast, President Biden heads south to Angola. There, officials say he planned to focus on U.S. leadership on trade, investment, and infrastructure in Africa. He'll also recognize Angola's president, João Lourenço's regional leadership and global partnership on trade, security, and health. More importantly, President Biden will highlight one of his signature initiatives, the investment of the Lobito Corridor, a regional railway project linking natural resource-rich areas stretching from the Angolan port of Lobito to the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia. The corridor is part of a wider joint effort between multiple partners aimed at closing the infrastructure gap in growing economies around the world, officials say. Dr. Francis Brown, Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council, speaking about the broader benefits associated with the project.
What I found really notable about the Lobito Corridor is that it isn't just about a railroad or critical minerals. It's also about the communities that are strengthened along the way. It's about more access to education. It's about agricultural products moving to market. And it's about increases in digital connectivity.
Last year, U.S.-Angola trade totaled approximately $1.77 billion, making Angola America's fourth largest trade partner in sub-Saharan Africa. Angola has vast mineral deposits and is Africa's third largest oil producer. But according to Amnesty International, the country's natural resource wealth has not translated to prosperity for most of its people, resulting in numerous peaceful protests against poverty, unemployment, and high cost of living. Nell says some Angolans may see a benefit with this Biden visit.
Maybe ordinary Angolans will recognize that Angola desperately needs to diversify its economy. And this is an enormous opportunity to do so, to move away from oil and gas and bolster other parts of the economy. So it has massive potential.
But others, including human rights campaigners and opposition parties, Nell says, will feel aggrieved by President Biden's visit because they see the Lourenco administration as being rewarded despite growing concerns about the shrinking space for independent civil society organizations and freedom of expression. In a new report, Amnesty International said that anyone who publicly criticizes the Lourenco government risks arrest. And, quote, if human rights are central to President Biden's foreign policy, then he must demand Angola's government immediately free arbitrarily detained government critics. Adriano Nuvunga, who runs the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Mozambique, echoes that sentiment.
I commend the people of Angola and President Lourenco for hosting President Biden. It means a lot for the people of Angola. While I commend them, I would also want to encourage President Biden to ask those tough questions to President João Lourenço. We have a number of human rights defenders in Angola that are detained unjustly, unfairly, for doing nothing. They are languishing in jail and some of them in critical condition.
Nuvunga hopes that this could be addressed during this trip. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Excitement is building in Paris as Notre Dame Cathedral reopens its doors this coming weekend, 5 years after a massive fire devastated the iconic Paris landmark that first opened more than 800 years ago. It marks a bright spot in an otherwise turbulent year in the French capital. VOA's Lisa Bryant is there.
Construction is still underway just days before Notre Dame's reopening. It's taken 5 years, 2,000 artisans and workers, and more than $700 million to restore the medieval Gothic masterpiece. For many here, that effort is worth it.
Moi, je suis...
Frenchman Dong Pan, who lives outside Paris, says he's proud France rebuilt Notre Dame using the old techniques and a cultural heritage that belongs not only to France, but to the entire world.
Mais je pense que du monde aussi.
In April 2019, many feared they had lost Notre Dame in a blaze that raced through the cathedral. French President Emmanuel Macron vowed it would be restored within 5 years. Millions of dollars in donations poured in. Craftsmen from around the world joined the monumental task. Father Gilles Drouin was involved in the cathedral's interior refurbishment. Father Gilles Drouin is director of the High Institute of Liturgy at the Catholic Institute of Paris. He hopes Notre Dame's reopening will be a moment of national unity, just like during the fire. That's rare, he says, for a country so polarized. He says it's the cathedral of all the French, not just the Catholic community.
L'émotion dépassait largement, évidemment, la seule communauté catholique, largement.
In October, Notre Dame's bells rang out for the first time in 5 years. Reopening ceremonies and mass will be held at Notre Dame next Saturday and Sunday. Foreign dignitaries have been invited. Pope Francis says he will not attend.
Notre Dame de Paris.
Father Drouin says Notre Dame is the cathedral of the bishop. He's the one to reopen it. So from a religious standpoint, it makes sense the Archbishop of Paris presides over reopening ceremonies.
Qui préside les célébrations de réouverture de la cathédrale.
Up to 15 million people are expected to visit Notre Dame yearly. Even with scaffolding, it inspires awe.
I've known in
Italian tourist Martina Felici says she's seen images of the cathedral since she was a girl. She says it's strange to see it in person. She thought it was smaller.
La pierre est
Belgian history teacher Nicolas Pidia says stone is more resistant than humans. He believes Notre Dame has centuries ahead of it.
Évoluer, etc.
Notre Dame's many fans hope he's right, and that the solidarity that helped to rebuild the cathedral will last. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. And follow us online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
We'll be right back.